Welcome to the Leadership Experience Podcast, where we seek to build connections, talk relevant issues about warfighting, and share professional knowledge through experience and lessons learned with guests from a variety of different professional backgrounds. It's our way to relate to multiple generations within our formation and create real conversations as we build a team of teams committed to winning and dedicated to the pursuit of excellence. We hope you enjoy our content. You can continue to find the Lancer Brigade on Facebook and Instagram, and find our podcast content on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts as you search for the Lancer Brigade or the Leadership Experience. Enjoy. Hey team, check it out. Today we welcome Mr. Alejandro Villanueva, starting offensive tackle for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Prior to playing for the Steelers, Mr. Villanueva deployed with both the 10th Mountain Division and 1st Ranger Battalion to Afghanistan. After finishing his last tour with the Rangers, Mr. Villanueva decided to pursue a career in the NFL. In 2014, he was spotted by the Steelers and is now a veteran and two-time Pro Bowler of the organization. His contributions today include stories of growth and development during his military career, the importance of challenging oneself, and the principles he carries with him both on and off the field. Hey, Alejandro, I appreciate you taking the time to sit down and have a conversation with us today.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much for having me. Good to see you.
Yeah, how's the family doing?
The family, we're all doing well. We're making the tough moral and ethical decisions on whether to send the kids to school and, you know, how we're going to, you know, deal with the next 6 months of my life, which are basically like a deployment at home. And we'll try to figure out everything else that comes, you know, with the season as we go.
So how are things with the COVID? I saw a couple of things on the highlight when you're watching, you know, Hard Knocks training camp. And so they're featuring both LA teams, and I see all the stuff that's going on. How's it going for you guys and the Steelers?
It's tough. It's really tough because a lot of the players, because COVID is a divisive issue. I feel like any issue that is divisive and involves the NFL, it automatically involves the life of people that have huge platforms on social media. And so when you have veteran players that have to do the testing every single day and have to wear a mask around, they come from states that maybe you don't have to wear the mask. And the social distancing is not as, it's not as accepted, you know, as other states, it becomes, you know, very tribal. And as we get closer to the election year, and as we get closer to all the things that are happening socially in our country, it just becomes one of the added things to the list. So COVID is becoming very stressful on people psychologically more than it is physically.
I think that's a great point. I mean, we're all like having some difficulty with some type of change. So just here, you know, and as an example, just in the small portion of what's going on in our unit, you know, things have changed in the sense of how we approach the problem sets. There's still the requirement to meet the same standards, but the conditions have obviously adjusted, so we had to put some mitigation. So if you came in now, everybody's wearing a mask. Doesn't matter if it's outdoor, indoor, in the facilities. You know, and then as you walk through, you're getting your temperature taken probably about 12 times a day as you're walking through this. Everybody had to rely on, you know, distributed comms, which is actually one of the reasons why we're doing these podcasts now. So instead of being an opportunity to do LPDs and gather large groups and in these type of forums, you know, get opportunities to sit down with a lot of interesting people that can share their stories and have some conversations, share some leadership gems. And then that way we can send it out to the team, whether they're watching it live or at another time.
That's awesome. How proactive is that? How typical of Laterco Chung is that to have this, the girl Chung, to have this, this LPD via podcast. That sounds more like you, sir.
Yeah, that's probably, you know, like a little bit of professional maturation, you know, when you recognize that the conditions have adjusted. So, you know, when we were in, 175, and even my days going back, you know, to 287 as a battalion commander, you can just rally everybody up pretty quick. But now it makes you stop and think about how do you own your footprint. So it's more than just putting paint on the wall. It's really about how are you establishing, you know, opportunities to communicate across the entire formation. And as you know, we've had some discussions and conversations with, you know, different warriors of, you know, different generations, but it's really the beauty about being in this institution, the profession of arms, is that You have multiple generations. So the same thing that you've mentioned before, right? You know, being a veteran player and rookies coming in, you know, there's a different set of values and there's a little bit of a gap. And, you know, I'm sure Coach Tomlin's trying to get everybody to, you know, push toward what the, with all the coaching or what all the organization values are. So it goes to this thing about touch points and listening points, right? And leaders being vulnerable and having these conversations.
Absolutely. So if there are different groups, you know, in the battalions, you got the Spec 4 Mafia, you know, you got the lieutenants, the butter bars, you know, and in the football world, I fall under the category of the grizzly veterans. when you have a grizzly veteran, you have to have three kids at home waiting for you. You try to, you know, you never change your clothes, you know, when you come in, always trying to leave the first, you know, try to leave early, push everything early in the morning. And it is interesting to have the different tiers in the NFL. It's very apparent in the military world, but in the NFL world, it's kind of eerie just how closely related they are. You know, how the young guys are just looking for the CIB of football, which is the Pro Bowl, and it's all that matters to them. It makes me think. You know, and I talk to, you know, to my teammates sometimes about this. You know, the different stages of your career when you go into an organization that you admire the culture so much and you're trying to fit in as best you can. The NFL is very much the same. They're these manly organizations that are driven by ribbons on your chest and driven by what other people say. And so it's really interesting to see how, you know, the old CIB mentality has not left my life yet. I'm still pursuing trivial things.
Well, you know, for those that aren't tracking, right, you're a two-time Pro Bowler, I think, at least, right? So that's a pretty significant. So you were in a CIB, both from the military and in the pro football world. So that's pretty awesome. And we'll get into your journey about it, but I appreciate you sharing that. That's some key insight on some of the things that you've seen in one profession and now as a professional athlete, some of the things that you're still seeing that are relevant. And so I think that some of the things you'll talk about with some leadership things you're going to see those parallels. You know, I was hoping that we were going to work this conversation at the same time my fantasy football draft was, so I could have old first star Ray Fuller here. And he goes, "Hey, who are you going to pick?" And I'm saying, "Don't worry. I got this guy, Alejandro Villanueva, who's going to make my first selection for me."
Yeah. It's funny. So I just got my training, my gambling training, which is kind of like the cat card training, the anti-terrorist level one. I have to sit through this briefing every year about what not to do. And so to me, I'm like, anything that's fantasy football or gambling, I can't say anything because otherwise I'll get in trouble. I don't even know if I get in trouble now, but I clearly didn't pay attention to the presentation. So now I don't know if I'm going to get it right or not. But I just took my test yesterday. I got my 8 questions right. And I think fantasy football was definitely mentioned in the whole thing. So I'm gonna stay away. Go with Ben Roethlisberger. That's the best recommendation I can give you.
Well, hey, you know, before we leave that, I heard, or at least I read online that you taught Juju Schuster how to drive. Is that true?
It is true because I didn't know how to drive when I went to the Army. I didn't have a car. I mean, I came from Europe, so here in the United States, people learn how to drive a little quicker when they're 16, I think. And so when I showed up to West Point, I didn't have a car, and I remember how embarrassing it was for me to ask somebody to please teach me how to drive because I didn't know how to do it. And, you know, obviously people were more focused on other things, you know, on the weekends, especially when you're in the military. You know, you're going to say like, all right, you know, I could go to down New York City or go have fun with my friends, but I'm going to sit here and teach this large human being how to parallel park in my little Honda Civic, you know? So if you can extend the courtesy, and I think, you know, in his case, he thought he could get around in life without having a driver's license. I think it was appreciated by him.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you know, we're having a lot of soldiers that are showing up, you know, that don't have a driver's license. They're trying to buy a car. So, I mean, it's a great parallel. How do I fit in? You know, a car represents a little bit of freedom. I can go do some things. So what you just mentioned there at West Point, and it's great to see that you end up paying for it. I kind of laughed because somebody had told me that same thing that, you know, they had to teach you. And so I was wondering, you know, like, you know, yeah, I got to teach this large human how to drive. I was telling somebody this story. I said I had just left 175 and I was up there at JSOC the first time I met you, and you were, I think, serving as the LNO. And Sony was like, "Yeah, he's the new lieutenant that's serving as LNO." And I was like, "Oh my gosh." I'm like, "What genetic lab did they grow this guy in?" You know?
Do you know the crazy thing that I thought for years about, you know, obviously everybody that are serving in the range of battalions always goes back to trying to decipher the culture, you know, of the battalions. And sometimes I catch myself laughing because the one cultural thing that was true is that for whatever reason, 1st Ranger Battalion just wanted to get the most massive, almost, it was the most gigantic lieutenants that they could find. And it was almost, and then I started thinking about it, I said, you know what? There's a little bit of a competition between the rips, between the battalions, because you get to see each other to the face. And when you show up, battalion character from the rings, the Shank or Bath, and you're doing a rip, and you say, like, here's my, when you're a battalion commander, you say, like, here's my lieutenant, he can beat your lieutenant. You know what I mean? So I always felt like size was one of the things that 1st Ranger Battalion was really looking forward to. And then obviously, once you show up to the gym, because of the maybe the association with the beach, you know, muscles, especially in the bicep area, were of huge importance in 175.
I remember when I was like, there's no way that this guy could run being that big. And then I saw you running and I was like, oh my goodness, this dude can run and he's this size. It was probably the same way when Tomlin saw you and says, like, you know, based on your size and how quickly you had the athletic ability. So there was no doubt the reason why they selected you.
Yeah, so I do the range of physical assessment test every single year in the offseason. I started when I left. I mean, you got to think, when I left the Army in 2014, it was a very tough decision for me because I was the XO of Alpha Company. To me, that transition into a more responsibility level seemed fascinating. The career progression of an officer when you have that experience of being in the Ranger Regiment is mind-boggling. It's almost like being in investment banking in New York City, and you feel like you're in the tip of the spear. You feel like you're doing absolutely everything you can for you're learning so much about leadership and values. And then I leave to go to the NFL, and I'm trying to figure out how this is going to work out. And in the U.S. was, you know, rising tensions with Korea, and everybody was sort of feeling that we're going to go to Korea. And I said, I'm going to miss Korea. There's no way I'm going to miss Korea. And so I started doing the RPFT every single offseason, just in case anything would happen. I would leave the NFL immediately, and I would try to, you know, join in, you know, at whatever stage of the conflict as possible. But, you know, obviously that was probably a lot of built up tension, you know, from the Army as it was transitioning out of Afghanistan, obviously with a bigger, broader international sort of situation that we're dealing with.
Absolutely. No, that's awesome. It gives everybody kind of that sense of, hey, that personal discipline that you carried, you know, from your time both being at West Point and the same portion of, you know, into 287, which I love, and then 175. So, you know, which was one of my other loves. And then I was wondering if we could go back, right? Let's just step in the time machine for a little bit and go back and share a little bit about your family. You know, I ask guys all the time, you know, whether you're a trailblazer or you kind of carving out your, you know, are you a legacy? And so I was wondering if you could share, you know, I know that your dad had served in the service as well, and what that meant, and then what did putting you and your brothers into sports, what did that teach you early on? Because I also know you got a brother that plays rugby or professional rugby, whether he still does or at least did it one time.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I was born in Meridian, Mississippi. My dad was an exchange student who's learning how to fly Harriers. So if you're an international student, you go to San Antonio. They teach you English for a little bit. Then you go to Meridian, Mississippi. They teach you how to fly, you know, a type of aircraft. I hate myself a little bit for not knowing this path, you know, of where I was born and why. And then you go to Pensacola, and then you learn how to fly reactors. Maybe I'm not sure. I'm sure some people are more familiar with the process. So I was born accidentally while my dad was doing the training here in the United States. And then when we came back, you know, to where I'm from, to Spain, my dad was stationed in Rota Naval Station, which is a joint base U.S. And American, very, you know, strategically positioned in the Strait of Gibraltar. I never understood that Russia does not have a lot of freshwater access. I mean, a lot of access to waterways. And so the Mediterranean was key. And so during the 50s, the U.S. created this base in the southern tip of Spain, between Spain and Africa. And that's where I grew up. And so the Marines were there. They have a whole bunch of ships. I don't know how many ships they have right now. And that was my daily life. I lived outside of a base. You know, if you want to make a comparison, you know, for a lot of people in the Army, I was probably a kid who grew up like outside of Manas, and you know, and you know, had just been born in the United States by accident, but that's just you know where it was. So the role models that I had growing up were the Marines who would come in to the PX or to the next, and they would buy logs of chewing tobacco, and they would walk around everywhere, and they would go to the gym and lift tons of weights, and they were just here on a rotational basis. So those are the people that I was seeing as I was a kid, like, wow, I want to be just like those guys. And then bullfighters from Spain. So I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm brave enough to be a bullfighter and dedicate myself to this. So the military always was a calling for me, especially after 9/11. My dad was doing the War College. We were in Newport, Rhode Island as an exchange student again. He actually went twice. And I remember being on the World Trade Center almost a couple of weeks before it came down. So it was very impactful for me, you know, that I was able to live all that. And then, you know, I saw the ramp up of the deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. So when I would be in class, you know, looking outside the window, wondering about my life and how boring whatever it is that I was learning, I would see nothing but C-5s and C-17s land, you know, full of materials, equipment, and obviously Marines who were getting ready to deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I, you know, in my mind, I could have conceived not serving. You know, I was looking at my life and I said, if I'm anything other than a soldier, then shame on me, because it's the only thing that I can consider myself as being. You know, maybe it's more of a manly thing. Maybe it's more of a cultural thing. I'm not really sure. But I tried to join the Marines. And when I was doing my physical test in Cape Town in Kaiserslautern, which is the medical base for armed forces in Europe, they told me that I was colorblind, and so I couldn't join the Naval Academy or the Navy. For those that are familiar with the test, is that the test with the circles, and there's numbers in it.
And the numbers, yeah.
Yeah, so I couldn't pass that test, so I couldn't go Marines. And then I obviously couldn't go to the Air Force Academy, become a pilot like my dad, and it left West Point as the only choice that I would have in the service academies. And you know, for me, you know, when I visited the academy, it was a little bit of am I really willing to live in the middle of the woods in this Harry Potter life, you know, for something that I could get out of ROTC? And am I about to put myself through this grinder? And ultimately it was the combination of academy life. My dad sold me this concept of academy life, of having everything basically done for you. I mean, you just have to wake up and go through the motions like everybody else is around you. You know, you're not going to have any privacy whatsoever. You're going to be doing exactly what your roommate is doing, just maybe 5 seconds later, you know, offset. And I enjoyed the academy. It was actually a pretty cool experience. I got to play football, you know, just to fit in. Everybody has to do a sport. And for me, it was either handball, swimming, or football. And I walked into the football team, and I realized that I could, you know, hang out with a bunch of really good dudes in a brotherly type environment, not judging ourselves constantly by our academic rank or how awesome we were doing. You know, more of, you know, let's just be really good friends and you know, say silly things to each other. And from that experience playing football, I started getting in contact with some of the football players that I would look up to. And all of them were infantry. And so I wanted to be an infantry officer. To me, that was the most important thing. I have to make sure that I served to the fullest of my capacity. Managing and leading men is exactly what I want to do. I can't fit in a helicopter, and I don't see myself doing anything else other than being just like those football players that did it ahead of me. And so I branched infantry, and then I went to Fort Benning for my schooling, got done with my schooling. 287 was my first assignment. 287 was, you know, picked, you know, by information they used to have based on the PAX charts. So I, you know, I remember not wanting to go to Drum, but saying if Drum is deploying, and that's the thing that everybody said about Fort Drum, you go to Fort Drum, you are deploying.
That's true.
Especially back in 2010. So I was able to get onto 3rd Brigade. Somebody told me that you want to be on 3rd Brigade because they're going to get their orders shifted from Iraq to Afghanistan. Obama had just come to a West Point and delivers a speech about the surge and the strategy, so we knew it was RC South. And that was all really exciting. I mean, to be able to have that much control We made the analogy of investment banking. I mean, these tips in the lieutenant world of this battalion is going here. You want to be on this battalion. It's going to be the main AO or the main effort. Those things were so significant. I mean, I know that times have changed tremendously, but to me, when I was a young lieutenant, that's the only thing that mattered. And so I was able to get onto 287. We went to Zari District, which was an awesome, you know, challenge in deployment. I learned so much about myself, so much about my peers. I started falling in love with the Army, what is the institution that it is, the Army. And then afterwards, I just wanted to find the next challenge. And so for most of us, it was SF or Ranger Regiment. And, you know, based on your style and your personality and what type of person you were, your haircut, maybe, you know, you were going to fall almost like the hats, you know, in Harry Potter. You are SF, you are Ranger Regiment. And in my case, I was fortunate enough, you know, lucky to be in 175, start all the way again from the bottom, and be exposed to that great culture that was the Ranger Regiment. And then afterwards, I think the Army was undergoing a BRAG movement, so they were removing a brigade from each division. And in my case, because of my year group, it would have basically delayed my career, you know, by a lot, just based on the fact that I was, you know, in Ranger Regiment. So I was a little bit late for my Triple C class. And then I would have had to wait at brigade for a heavy unit, maybe Fort Hood or Lewis, and then, you know, get command. And so the wait time became, you know, pretty stressful to deal with, you know, the fact that I don't know what my career at that point was going to be. I've been able to have so much success managing everything that I could, from waiving my leave after graduation to go to the first eye bullet class so that I could get the first Ranger class. So, I mean, I was considering failing airborne school so that I would get up to Fort Drum the quickest, until somebody told me, you do not want to be the person that fails airborne school, you know, for no reason. And, you know, at that point, it was that lull of, now you got to go back into the big Army. It scared me a little bit. I was afraid that I would never be able to get to deploy again, or never be able to have the career that you had and all my, you know, my superior officers were having, which was bouncing back from great unit to great unit. And at that moment, I think a lot of lieutenants, especially from the Ranger Regiment, they realized, okay, you know, I can maybe try to go out and make it big in the civilian life. And for me, it was a little bit of an ambitious project. I was very hesitant at all times of doing this, because I felt as if there was still an opportunity for me to maybe finish my XO time in 1st Ranger Battalion, go to Triple C, maybe get fished by somebody from a good light infantry mechanized unit. You know, the transition from light to heavy was something also that I was not looking forward to. And stay in the Army and go come back to regiment or go to teach at West Point or do the type of things that you can do once you start getting a little more rank as an officer in the Army. But I don't know why I was so bitter. You know what I mean? I was so bitter that the deployments were getting dried out. I was still so caught up in this young mentality of going to get the CIBs, the things that I thought mattered at the time. And I try to go out and audition for the NFL during my block leave time after I got back from a rotation. And then from there, everything was very, very lucky. Tough process to get out of the Army, because, you know, I had to negotiate with the Department of Defense on how we're gonna account for the 7 months that I owed of service. So I had to serve in the reserves, pay back some money. I had to do a whole bunch of things. And, you know, ultimately, I was very, very fortunate that it worked out in the NFL. But at all times, I was always regretting having left the military for something that, you know, the expected value of an NFL player is not very positive. It's almost the fact that I made it in the NFL is laughable. It's not admirable. It's laughable, you know, just because it's such a rare thing. And, you know, you don't know who's gonna make it or not. A lot of it has to do, kind of like Ranger school. Sometimes, especially, you know, I remember when I used to go through, when I went through Ranger school, if the RIs like you and they don't pick on you too much, you know, then you make it through. But sometimes they just pick on you. They pick on you and they make it so impossible that you don't make it. That's kind of how the NFL is. It's a Ranger school every year where every person is picking on you, and you have to try to make it, you know, to play another season. And that's where I am right now. I have to finish in my 7th training camp in the NFL.
That's a great story. I was wondering if we just go back when you were talking that first experience in combat. What was that like? And you know, I know you walked away, and there's a Valor Award, and there's an experience that you have. And you know, when you end up experiencing something that's very, very difficult, you know, in times of adversity, it makes those that you serve on the team with grow a lot closer, and you end up having this bond. I was wondering if you could share with those that are in that same position, because there's a lot of lieutenants. You know, I'm the old guy now, you know, over 60 months in combat, and I keep telling all these young lieutenants, like, you know, just got to be patient, because when it comes, and if the Army ends up deploying again, trust me, everybody will go, and then I've seen it on the opposite side, you know, and you've seen the same thing. How many times, you know, both NCOs and officers will keep going overseas, and it gets to the point that you start to see it, you know, kind of wear on them a little bit. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that combat experience that you had when you were in 287.
Oh, absolutely. So I felt as if my combat experience began when I was at the military academy, when I started understanding the makeup of a uniform. When I started understanding patches and what they meant, you know, when you have a scroll on a shoulder, that means that that person has been with Ranger Regiment. All those things, to somebody who comes into the military, they're foreign terms. You know, the Marines didn't have anything. The Marines were just, you know, back in the day, there was just the Marines. But the military, and I mean, the Army was a lot different. So I remember that I always wanted to be a light infantry soldier, because those patches, to me, they just meant more. And I was so fixated on being 18th Airborne Corps or a unit that was assigned a specific AO that you knew you're going to be able to have the romanticized experience of combat that you always dreamed of. Because you think about combat every single night when you're at West Point, your, you know, junior and senior year, and obviously when you're doing all your training at Fort Benning, the only thing that you talk about is combat, is when you become a PL and when you are in combat, this is what you have to do. So my first experience, and this is funny that you were talking about earlier about the young lieutenants in the battalion, it's never gonna match what you think it is. It's never gonna be as valorous or as splendid as you have it in your dreams or in the movies or anywhere else that you've seen, because the amount of time in between events, it's so large that you become accustomed to deployment life. So I feel like deployment life is more accurate than combat. And deployment life has a lot of ups and downs, a lot of uncertainty. When I first came into the battalion, I was at the S3. And my job was, obviously assistant of the assistant S3. And my job was to call all the company commanders and ask them what key leader engagements they've had that day. So if they've talked to a village elder, what did they say? And as you can imagine, most of the company commanders and the AO were just focused on combat operations, and they could care less about KLEs and the KLE manager for the AS3. So I was in the battalion headquarters for my first maybe month and a half, 2 months, waiting for a platoon to open up. And it was really interesting. You know, just the pain and the agony that the Butterbar is feeling all day as he's sitting in battalion headquarters, and everybody sees him come by in and out every day, and it's very similar to that of the player who's on the bench on a football game, and he's dying to be out there, but he's just, his opportunity is not there yet. I feel like as if you, what you want to see all the time is that player wants to be on the field, and he's ready to do it. So that's sort of my mentality. I was talking to the PSD every day. Is the battalion commander going out, even just to check on a culvert denial system that we were implemented in the battalion? Anything. Can I please come and can I see it? Can I see the AO? Can you take me out of this battalion headquarters? And, sure enough, just like you're talking about, one day I wake up, I think it's a normal day, and my battalion commander says, hey, you're going to Alpha Company, you're going down to Sandre, pack up your bags, and you're going tomorrow. And the next day, you meet a platoon, you go over the very, very basics, your rifle, and then, you know, 2-3 days later, patrol later, you know, bullets are flying, and now you're in the first firefight of your life, and you have to do the things that you've been called to do. And I remember it was almost like it was yesterday. I think it was like, you know, May 19th, 2011. We were doing a clearance patrol, clearance of NAIs around the San Jose River Valley, the Argonne River Valley. And, you know, we start getting small arms fire, 2-3 AKs shooting at us, probably from 200 meters or so. And I remember my first initial reaction when everybody laid down fire, we're going to flank. And not even thinking about it. I said, we're going to flank. This is Battle Drill 1 Alpha. This is what I've been trained to do. This is what we do in Ranger School. This is what we do in IBC. This is what I do in all my training events. We lay down suppressive fire, and then we flank. And so I remember, you know, when you do a training exercise, you have an expectation. You know, you almost have to follow the footsteps of the unit that did it before you, you know, on that flank element. And all the RIs are posting their, you know, their limits that they've, you know, gone through with range control and whatnot. And this is completely different. This is now the angle of the flank is maybe not as perfect as it is at a range. And you have to now operate in complete space. And now you have this variable of the Afghan National Army that you have to shift fires with. And I'm thinking about all this as I'm beginning to flank. And I'm thinking, is a flank even, should I even be flanking right now? I mean, it's crazy. Nobody's questioning anything. We're just flanking. I mean, should I be charging the enemy? I mean, what am I getting out of two or three guys? Why am I chasing two or three guys? And so at that moment, I just stopped. I said, let's just stop. You know, what do we do? You know, what am I doing here? What's the purpose? You know, why am I trying to shoot these two, three guys? What is the tactical advantage? I mean, am I walking to an ID? Who knows if there's 15, 16 guys back there? There's just too many questions. I was still in Ranger School mode. And so I was able to catch myself. And then you realize that by the time you catch yourself, you come back and linked up with the enemy. I mean, with the rest of the friendly element, and the firefighters ended. It was just, you know, it was just a couple pop shots. It was not the firefight that you thought it was going to be. It's not there yet. You still have to process all the information, and you still have to, you know, learn how to think on your feet. So once the deployment went underway, once I had, you know, 20, 30 firefighters underway, it was more of a routine thing. If you get into this area of the AO, you're going to get shot at from these two, three houses. If you feel like it's worth it to go there and clear them, then go there and clear them, but understand the risk. Here are the HLZs, and you were able to think yourself through the night about all the different things that could go wrong, and the comfort level. I mean, the how fast a young lieutenant is learning is unbelievable, because he has no other experiences to compare it to. So for him, that first initial AO is the AO. You cannot compare it to RC East. I mean, I remember I had so many soldiers from RC East that have been deployed, you know, to the mountains in Logar and Paktika. And for them, it was very scary to get shot at close quarters, like in RC South, you know, because the distances are probably 100 to 200 meters, and RC East are 800 meters. So all these little nodes, all these little things were really fun to learn. And then towards the end, you almost start feeling like a warrior. Like, hey, you know what? I learned especially from all the NCOs. You don't know anything. You know, you're so clueless out there. You have to have NCOs that want to see you develop and want to see you grow. They have to be on your side and have to cheer for you, because if not, you're just waiting to fail. And then, you know, it's cool to be somebody that when you go to battalion headquarters, you know, the NCOs are proud to parade you around and say, yeah, you know what, that's my lieutenant. You know, when they talk to another NCO, they say, like, yeah, that's my lieutenant right there. He's not bad. You know, they're always going to be judging you and talking about you. I feel like that was sort of the gratification of being able to make myself a catamount and be in the battalion and feeling like one of the a member of the team.
I appreciate you sharing, you know, and what you're talking about. So if we kind of went back, and for those that are listening, so what you were taught, you know, about executing the battle drill, and that's the whole reason. So there isn't really any thought. So you can return fire. You know, there's no requirement for any type of, you know, actions or directions to give. So it gives the opportunity for a leader to assess the situation and make a decision, which is, it sounds like that's exactly what you end up doing. You know, as you're executing, you know, what guys are going into it, it's like, hey, hang on. You're assessing all these things are going on. They're firing in your mind, you know, so you can look at the situation and go, hang on, why are we doing this? And then you're able to see. And I appreciate you sharing. It's about the experience and the growth through the entire piece of combat and what you do. And when you come back, it changes, you know, your approach. It changes how you focus on training, and it changes, you know, how you prepare. It doesn't matter what you're going to be doing next, because you can see the value of what you're learning. that's the challenge, right? For leaders that have been to combat and training a force that is not yet gone. So when you're going through this time frame when you were serving, it's very easy to say, hey, you know, what you're going to do, you're going to see applicable in a combat. It's kind of the same way as, you know, I would imagine on the field. Hey, you know, when we play this team, hey, this is what's going to end up happening. And then they end up seeing it happen. It's like, oh, okay, I remember, you know, what you were saying. And then I really appreciate you highlighting the value of the officer and NCO relationship. And so I was wondering if we could tease on that just a little bit more about the value of what a platoon sergeant means to a platoon leader's development, and then the same thing of what squad leaders do, you know, for your growth, both in the time that you were in 287 and in the Ranger Regiment.
That is the ultimate LPD question that you can ask platoon leaders as soon as they get to the Ranger Regiment is, what should your relationship be with your platoon sergeant? It is such an enigma, and it is such a tough question to answer, because it makes you or breaks you as a lieutenant. It is the hardest. It is the thing that every single lieutenant wants to find. They want to figure it out the quickest, because they know that their success is completely married to whether they can work effectively together. And just like it happens in football, when the organization has to decide between the lieutenant and the NCO, most likely it's going to be the officer who's going to be the one being removed from the situation. So that's not, I mean, I think in Ranger Regiment, what do they call it? The Black Chinook, something like that. You know, that experience, that expression of, you know, having a Chinook to come pick up the officer. You know, I think that the one value and the one sort of attribute that you learn for anybody, for the alpha males, for the go-getters, for every single person that wants to go into an organization that is bigger than themselves, is that they have to do everything that they can for other people and nothing for themselves. So if you do everything every single day with the intention of bettering those around you and not yourself, indirectly speaking, you're going to help your cause as a leader. As soon as people start identifying that you're doing things for yourself and your own benefit, that creates a dynamic of power struggles, of Game of Thrones types, and it just ends up tearing down the culture and the atmosphere of the building. You know, it's somewhat what's happening in politics in today's society. You cannot have a conversation in the platoon cough and then start picking sides or start arguing about the decisions that one made and defending the others. So, you know, that humility of the lieutenant has to be, you know, in my opinion, the first and foremost attribute that is going to determine the success of that platoon at the leadership level. The humility of the platoon leader. You don't know anything. You are there to learn, and you are a member of the platoon that has to go through all the same requirements. And I mean, to me, it's almost unimaginable that a platoon leader would ever want to be something above the lowest private in the organization when it came to standards or when it came to anything that could be measured between the two of them. And then the second is the platoon sergeant to understand that he's the one that has to teach the platoon leader what his role is, that sometimes the platoon leader needs help understanding and identifying that role. I used to get counseled every single week by my platoon sergeant in Ranger Regiment. And the counseling was not a form that he would pull out and he would counsel me. It was a notebook that he used, and he would write down all the things and all the decisions that I made. And, you know, at the end of the week, he would go over them with me. And he'd say, you know what, sir, you know, when you're given this, you know, this present, you know, the briefing, the landing spot on this, I felt like you were too verbose. And you could have been, you know, more clear on your language. You know, I think that you maybe talk too much sometimes. Okay, that's great advice. And so you start finding your role as a platoon leader, but it has to be something that both of them have to do together. And oftentimes you'll find either a platoon leader that wants to do it all by himself, or a platoon sergeant who doesn't want to help the platoon leader, and then he ends up, you know, bearing himself or not being able to understand what his role is, because I believe, especially in Ranger Regiment, when you had, you know, towards the later, you know, deployments in the 2014, 13 and whatnot, you had, you know, the platoon sergeant, the platoon leader, and the ground force commander all at the same time in the same compound or the same objective. So for them to say, what's the difference, you know, from a platoon sergeant's perspective, he knows he's taking care of everything. The only thing he needs to hear is a task and purpose. But then you have two people given him, but I think that the relationship between the platoon sergeant was something that defined my success and defined anything that I ever did in the military. And I was always very careful of making sure that he came first in the marriage, almost like I do with my wife every single day. And then with the platoon the squad leaders, I think the squad leader position is the hardest by far in the infantry world, because you are the effective, you carry the responsibility of accomplishing tasks that can have a task and purpose, you know, whether it's provide security, you know, whether it's to assault an element. And I feel as if the magic, the relationship that you have between each member of the squad is valued tremendously, because a lot of times it's that private is going to have to do something for the other private that's next to him, and they have to give, you know, their life for each other, and they have to believe in each other and what they're doing, and fight together and move at the same pace and hold each other accountable at a much higher priority than anybody else, any other two members of the platoon.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the points you mentioned, number one, it's having that self-awareness to, you know, to be humble and have and experience that humility. And that's tough. You know, as you mentioned, hey, you wanted to get out of West Point, you wanted to get all these badges and everything. And then you come in and you got to listen to this individual who's going to tell you you're not doing as, you know, some great stuff, or, hey, here's what you need to do. And you're getting constructive criticism every day. But I, you know, one of the best advice that I've received, you know, going through one as a lieutenant, and then two, what I would offer to him, the same thing that was handed to me, is you got to be a sponge, you know, soak everything that you can that's up. And every one of those non-commissioned officers are going to be invested in you, and they're going to take care of you one way or another, right? And then the second thing is, I think that you mentioned about the platoon sergeant and this responsibility to train the platoon leader, because what he's invested in you is to make you a better company commander when you get to that point. And so I would offer the example, right? A lot of times to lieutenants, it was like, you know, when you show up to inspect CQs by yourself, you know, this natural, you know, reaction that CQ is going to be like, you know, hey, sir, the only reason you're here, they're not going to tell you this, but they're going to be thinking, the only reason that you're here is because someone's making you do this. Or number two, you're thinking, hey, the only reason, or when's the last time that you've ever lived in a barracks? That's a different message when a PL and a platoon sergeant are going together to the barracks, and the platoon sergeant's like, okay, hey, sir. He looks at him and says, hey, sir, show him the visitor's log and explain to the platoon leader, hey, this is what's going on. Hey, sergeant, show him right here. Here's what the breakdown of everybody that's in the barracks or not. Now it's a teaching moment, right, as they're going through. When I was a platoon leader, I had a platoon sergeant every morning. He'd be like, hey, sir, you ready to go? Take me upstairs. And he'd make me, you know, walk through with him, and he would pick up the squad leaders who would walk through every one of those rooms and go, okay, get down to formation. And he wasn't teaching me that so I could inspect rooms. He was teaching me these things so when I became a company commander, I would know what right looks like from my non-commissioned officers. And that became incredibly invaluable. When I was in 287, I used to tell the battalion, if your lieutenant shows up to the barracks by himself, the CQs, you're supposed to detain him until a platoon sergeant would come and get him, you know, because they should never, a platoon leader should never be by himself. And part of it goes back to what you were saying, is because a platoon sergeant has that responsibility to make sure he's prepared to put him in the right place to make the best decision possible. Because just as you mentioned that last piece with squad leaders, you know, squad leaders have this awesome responsibility and that difficulty to accomplish those tasks. That's why it's very important that the platoon leader can convey the purpose of why they're doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think platoon sergeants sometimes are really excited, you know, oh, I'm going to be in 2 Bravo. I don't know why every single 2 Bravo, you know, platoon in infantry is almost like the coolest. I'm going to be the 2 Bravo platoon sergeant. But then you're forgetting that you have to deal with the officers going to be attached to you. And sometimes, you know, I'm sure there's great platoon leaders, there's not so great platoon leaders. But it's a part of the job that if you have a really good one, and you know, obviously, especially if you get to the ranger regiments, they understand, they've seen it growing up. They saw mommy and daddy, you know, argue when they were privates, and they saw that it led nowhere. But I think that is a very difficult answer that all platoon leaders have to deal with. And I remember having these philosophical conversations with myself, almost like as I was Socrates talking to Plato regarding, you know, what should I do with my platoon sergeant if X, Y, and Z happens and whatnot. And, you know, ultimately, I think the powerful culture of the Ranger Regiment is able to guide you almost like as the force, like Yoda would say, you know, and then beautiful things happen. You end up having a great time, and you learn more about yourself from this precise counseling that you get from non-commissioned NCOs that are looking for the betterment of the platoon, not you as an officer.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, I share with the team all the time that, that I'm a product of non-commissioned officer investment. So when they ask me, you know, why I am the way I am and the focus and on exacting standards and about the preparation and building this discipline and all that, it's because I was raised by non-commissioned officers who showed me every level of the way of what right looks like. So it wasn't like these things I just came up with in, on my own in my head. It's because I've had a non-commissioned officer every time that I've gone through at some aspect in some rank showing me and then sitting down and saying, okay, hey, sir, you just heard what the commander's intent was. Here's how I see us laying this portion out. And you mean you saw that same thing when you were going through time-sensitive targetings, right? So you could go through and say, hey, here's the mission set that we have. I think we're going to do this type of landing. I think here's the combat. Here's how I see the color sides of the building. And then right away, you have all the squad leaders. They're going to get on and they're going to make that plan better, right? And you just watch, you know, that platoon sergeant sitting back and he's watching how this plan develops. And then so he sees the platoon leader kind of directing, you know, this engagement of all these leaders. And then he stops and goes, you know, the platoon leader goes, hey, platoon sergeant, are we missing anything? And then he'll highlight, you know, he's throwing his wisdom in that portion of it. And he's really being stepping back on that key piece of terrain. And now we're really talking about how we're mitigating risk before they execute that mission. And those that have done that the best, you could see that in that relationship. You know, there was a time to be a counsel, there was a, or a counselor. There was a time, you know, that he said, okay, Roger that, sir. We're going to do what you just told us to do. And then there was a time that you know, he needed something else. You know, it's almost like to sit down and, hey, let's talk about this just in your personal development, you know, that you're going to do as you're going through life. And so I think the examples you laid out there is pretty neat. It's going to resonate with the team.
Yeah. I remember that one of the advice, the piece of advice that my sergeant major gave me of 287 when I got there was let everybody talk and then you just have the last word. And that was a really easy way of putting it, you know, because everybody's going to be talking and having discussions about the mission and whatnot. And they almost have to sell it to you. And then you are the one that approves it or you oversee everything. And so, but don't get me wrong. A lot of times, especially when you first get to your unit, the platoon sergeant has to do everything. I mean, he's doing everything and he's giving you a radio just so you can hear what's going on in the mission. But that was one of the unfortunate events. Of taking over a platoon leader who got hurt in Afghanistan, and you had to go in there to fill up the slot.
Hey, so I was wondering if we could transition just a little bit. So I know that you're a father now, and so when you talk about all these things that your dad had done, and you kind of modeled this life of selfless service, you know, both as you were going through and experiencing both in the United States, and then, you know, as you mentioned there, growing up in high school, that kind of, you know, imparted some values and a work ethic that led you to go to West Point and then you know, eventually serve in the military. Now, as a father, what lessons do you take from him that you pass on to your own kids?
So it's tough. So my father never wanted me to play sports. He never cared about sports whatsoever. That's one of the things that I feel as if I'm going to be the same way with my kids. I think you play, and this is funny coming from a professional football player, you know, but to me, my dad always said, you know, stress yourself with school and then have fun playing sports. But if you're playing sports and you're stressing yourself, you're taking away from the stress that you need, which is, you know, school. So that's the first one. Academics has to be in your culture. You know, your family has to be known for being a studious family. You know, you can be many things. You know, you can say, you know, that family over there in the corner, they play sports and they're great. They got a kid that plays baseball, a kid that plays basketball, a kid that plays football. And I mean, that's going to get you to be popular in school. It's going to get you to make a lot of friends. You know, it's going to teach you a lot about competitiveness. It's going to teach you a lot about you know, resolve and the things that happen, you know, the course of your life. But academics is going to get you to places. Academics is always going to help you open doors and give you opportunities. And so my family was always huge on learning, on reading books, on speaking a lot of languages, you know, which is very, very challenging for kids. And I feel that the the fact that my dad made it so difficult and challenging my whole life made everything else very easy. I was always 2-3 years ahead in any math that I ever learned. I never learned any math that was new at school. It was always something that my dad had already taught me. You know, how to land nav using the stars. I mean, skills that are so, you know, you would think why would a kid want to learn these things? Why would he need to know them? But in reality, they teach you how to be very methodical and very diligent. And so I feel, you know, that out of all the things that I've learned, not a lot of them can be transferable, as if I was in the Navy and I could teach my kid how to land navigate and how to change engines and do all those things. But as many skills that I can pass down to my kid, and especially a lot of emphasis on academics. And I think, you know, I see it all the time when I see parents that are pushing their kids all the way through the NFL to make sure that they make the roster, and how stressful that is on kids. It breaks them. If your dad is still pushing you by the time you get to the NFL, you know, chances are that the emotional backlash of something wrong happening in the NFL, it's almost going to break your relationship with your dad. So to me, sports is an awesome thing to have for fun, to get to know friends, to get to know a lot about yourself, but always as a hobby and never as something to center your entire life around.
That sounds like it's great advice. I mean, really just to be a lifelong student of your profession or of whatever craft or your passion. Because I know you, whatever you took in learning with academics, I know you take that same thing when it comes to studying and preparing, you know, for whatever game it is, even though, you know, it is football and sports. But who was the coach that gave you the insight that laid out and said, hey, Alejandro, I think we can take this to the pro level?
Every single time you get a look to come into the NFL, you have a chance. And a lot of those things are, you know, tangible things. If you're very tall and very big and you can run fast, you have a chance to make it in the NFL. The second thing is the mentality of succeeding in the NFL. It's almost as if, you know, every person that knows how to do math can go and work for Goldman Sachs. And they can have a career and again, investment banking, a high stress, desired job after you get done with your education. But to be able to do it every single day and to be able to have a career in it, it's very, very, very difficult on the mind. Your brain starts going a little crazy. So when I met Coach Tomlin, I started learning a lot about his philosophy in life, not only as an African-American coach in a league that is comprised of 80% African-American players and barely has any coaches. I mean, those sort of things that you have to deal with all the time as part of your profession give you a very peculiar philosophy in life. And his was stoicism. You know, for him, you know, he never let anything, any of the outputs of the world influence his decision-making ability. It's taking the emotions out of absolutely everything. Never get yourself filled with hopes and ideas and dreams that are then going to just let you down and, you know, discourage you from doing the work, because that's what happens to a lot of players. They you know, they work really hard as long as things are going great. And once things start going south, for whatever reason, you know, things are out of your control, then at that point they stop working. They stop, you know, because their emotions have just plummeted. So Coach Tomlin, you know, almost assured me that having the ability to deal with adversity and different environments and adapt into different situations, you know, highs and lows, was going to be very beneficial in the NFL. And it was more important than having some of the tangibles, pedigree, and attributes that most NFL players have in the NFL, such as played in the SEC, 900 pounds, and a run of 4.4. You know, I didn't have any of those things. But mentally, I was able to reason with everything that was happening from the, you know, from the media to, you know, your teammates and the sense of urgency in a competition environment such as training camp, you know, where they have 90 players and they only keep 53. And so I feel that his confidence and his ability to see something in me was more important than anything that I did for myself. You know, and it always goes back to the platoon sergeant sort of relationship. You know, somebody was behind it, helping me through every step of the way, because even though I was able to do it and sort of be in the roster, to have the cold mind of making a mistake and then going out to practice the next day or the next snap and be able to perform again is very, very difficult. You know, so for the receivers, they call it the yips. You know, for other players, you just call it hitting the tank. And you see down spirals in this profession all the time. Because if your mind is not able to hold everything together, it just breaks and then you're a useless player on the field.
That's interesting. You know, we had a recent conversation with Ryan Holiday, who's the author of a lot of...
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely.
Ego's the enemy. Yeah.
That's right. Ego's the enemy, obstacles away. So it was a great conversation. You know, it's kind of the modern day, you know, stoic, and he's communicated a lot of those same things. That's interesting because, you know, and I appreciate you sharing that about Coach Tomlin, because you could see that when he's doing all his press conferences, something may happen, you know, when Roethlisberger got injured or, you know, a big game that they expected to win and something had happened. He's pretty reserved, you know, as he's walking through, and he stays pretty calm as they're going through those things. That's pretty neat to see, as hear from a player that kind of talks about, you know, building this ability to control what you can control, as you know, the Stoics would end up saying. And then the piece that I think not everybody would know, because we haven't really talked about it, is, you know, what I understood is you, when you graduated West Point, 6'9", what do they say on the tape? 6'9", 250, 260?
Yeah, 6'9", 245.
Yes. And so, you know, now having to go up and play in the NFL, give everybody an idea of what you had to do to get to that level.
Oh, yeah. So that's really interesting because, you know, I do remember a lot of similarities in, I mean, the NFL, what you realize is that every person is its own CEO when it comes to your body. You know, you make the decisions for your body. Nobody else makes them for you. No, you know, maybe a lot of time I had the perception that when you join an NFL team, you join an elite group of nutritionists, an elite group of, you know, physical trainers, and then you get to become, you know, who they mold you into somebody. That happens at college, but it does not happen at the professional level. At the professional level, most players train on their own and they show up for games. You know, they go to lift on their own. Sometimes they don't like the team lifts, and they do everything by themselves. The mindset that you have to have as a platoon leader in the Army is very similar, because your body is also, it's your company, you know, as an officer. I mean, in a very distant, you know, sort of comparison. If you can do and crush PT tests, you're going to have a lot of opportunities. People are going to look at you differently, especially in the infantry world. It's very, very valuable to run a sub-12 2-minute miles and max out all the push-ups and sit-ups. So when I was in the Army, when I was in Ranger Regiment, I started doing a lot of research on working out. Started doing a lot of research on how to, because I was not a very good runner. I was a horrible long distance runner at West Point. And I said to myself, if the only thing that's going to hold me back from being a Ranger Regiment is the fact that I cannot run fast, then shame on me. I must be able to figure out this that everybody else can do. So I started doing a lot of research. I started trusting sources, understand a lot of, I mean, trial and error with a lot of, you know, methods of fitness and how to work out. And then once I found out how my body worked and I was able to be in tune with it, then I was able to manipulate my body extremely easy. So I'm a natural 260. When I was in Ranger Regiment, maybe 275. But in a matter of 6 months, I can be, you know, 330 pounds. You know, obviously a much higher, you know, body fat percentage. But I was able to at least give you 3 hours a week of performance. You know, I cannot give you anything on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. But Saturday and Sunday, I'll feel good enough to play a football game. And so I started understanding these mini cycle of the combat week, the training cycle that it is, the NFL season. You know, you only have to play good 3 hours a week. That's it. You don't have to worry about being in shape every single morning. You have to listen to your body a lot more and figure out you know, what is it that you're being required to do. And so when I started analyzing the offensive tackle position, I realized that, you know, there's a lot of reps. You're playing every single rep of the game. That's 80 times that you're playing, you know, the position a week. So if you ever do a strength test, you know, you realize that, you know, you cannot do 80 reps of anything at a lot of weight. It's a lot of endurance. It's not so much explosiveness of being able to bench a lot of weight. So instead of going the route of I'm going to try to bench as much as I can, I went the route of I'm going to try to bench a set amount of weight as many times as I can. So I had these workouts that I came up with when I was at Murphy, at, you know, as an LNL, where I would try to do 100 reps of a specific weight in as in 10 minutes. So I'll do, you know, this is a good example. My favorite one was 225 bench press, try to do it 100 reps as quickly as I could. And I only had to do it once a week. That was the only time of the week that I would bench, that I would do anything that was upper body in that motion. And so what I started, you know, focusing on was maximizing all my performance just for one time, just for that one test, just for that one specific event. And I became a very poor practicer. I mean, I look very lazy when I'm practicing, but on the games, I'm able to focus all my energy into that performance. So ability to control my body weight, ability to control and understand the training, like what is it that I'm actually being, you know, tasked to do and how can I match it with my training? You know, similar to what you do as an infantry officer, you know, your whole life. I feel like those were the two keys to be able to go from, you know, 245. I've never played football in my life at the tackle position, pass protecting, to now being able to change your body and doing it. So a lot of thinking through things and a lot of making sure that every single thing that I did on the gym had a purpose that was related to the outcome that I would desired whenever I desired it.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things you highlight is, you know, you're focusing on when you want to maximize everything that you have, right, during game time. So you're preparing just like we did for, you know, for combat. There's only so many times that we're going to be able to do combined arms live fires. There's only so many times that we can execute platoon live fires. But what are you doing day to day? You know, as you mentioned, right? So there's still that prep once a week that you're able to do it 100 times, you know, at a weight that you can. So you're building muscle memory to go through that. So when you're required to be able to do this for 3 hours. So what I'm hearing is very similar to the same point. It's, you know, I don't really care that you can run 2 miles, you know, the fastest that you possibly can, you know, like in 10 minutes, that at the end of that, you're completely drained. So how do I do this where I can, you know, run 2 miles, transition, now I've got to do pull-ups, transition, now I've got to do something else, transition, because there will be a time that I'm required to do that. And as you know, both on combat and on the battlefield, there is going to be a time frame that you don't know. In football, it's a little bit more defined. You know how long that combat time frame it is, but in combat itself on the battlefield, it could be 3 hours. But it could actually go longer than 3 hours where you have gunfights that you're up there sustained for, you know, over 10, 15 hours that you're out there. So it's interesting. If I took away some key points, there is one, you got to know your body. So how you work out, how do you maximize efforts on those things? How do you optimize things with your nutrition? And then the second portion of it is there's a lot of discipline that goes into it. So I know you said, hey, even when you went to practice, you'd be lazy, but you found a way to still be disciplined to go through the 80 reps and then to make sure you're ready to go and to maximize every effort that you have as you're going through this. You know, we do squad competitions here monthly, and it tests all these different things, right? It's the grind of, you know, PT. Do you have the skills to land nav? Do you have the skills to execute for weapons? Do you understand, you know, key things that are all that are going to be called upon? Like the first time that someone needs to put on a tourniquet, hopefully it's not the first time that he's actually putting on a tourniquet, you know, or executing those. So what is it? You don't have the number of times in the, you know, hours in a day. So what is it that you're working on to continue to make sure that you have those reps that when you need to call upon that for that surge, that you get a chance to do that? I was also interested in the sense that, you know, when you grow and you put on all that weight and then to have the discipline to go back to your comfortable weight, you know, that takes a lot when it comes to your nutrition and diet and exercise as well. I was wondering if you could share some things with the team on how do you maintain that, you know, both in the prep for the season and then after the season as well.
Of course. So as I said earlier, you are your own CEO. You make all the decisions for absolutely everything. The coaches that you deal with every day, they don't know anything about physical fitness. Most of my coaches are overweight. Most of them don't understand any concept of calisthenics or stretching or anything. They just evaluate the film. So it's up to you to find out what is it that you're going to be doing throughout the week to get yourself ready to play on Sundays. So I'll give you my routine. This is the typical routine of an NFL player. For me, this will be my seventh season. You know, that's another advantage that I have, or that you have in the NFL over the Army, is that you have a lot of continuity. And your NFL season is almost like a simulation. So each year you can alter and tweak little things and you get to do the simulation all over again and you can compare and contrast results. Usually when you're in the military, you have 3 years and by the time you figure it out, boom, next assignment, and then everything starts over again. So my week starts on Wednesday. Wednesday is the week where the team gets together and you introduce the opponent for that week. It reminds me of a car, a combined arm rehearsal, you know, where all the coaches will get up there. You know, the head coach will give an overview of the key players. He will talk special teams, offense, defense, the keys to victory. You know, how can you beat this team? How can this team beat you? And then you go into the base fronts. So what are you going to be seeing first and second down? What is the looks that they're going to have when you have your base personnel on the field? And you do that on Wednesday. And on Wednesday, you don't lift any weights. You have a full pad of practice. So it's the rehearsal of the plays in the most physical form that you can recreate them other than the game. And the day usually starts around, I would say, 6:30. And it goes all the way until 5 o'clock. That's your Wednesday. And Wednesday and Thursday are your two longest days. I drink all my water in the morning. I don't drink any water after practice. Maybe one small bottle of water after practice, but I drink most of my water all in the morning. One of my biggest issues that I found is that I have to be able to sleep and not get up to use the bathroom at night. If I do that, it interrupts my sleep. And I realize, you know, especially over the years, that the longer and the higher quality of sleep that you can get is going to determine your performance. You know, like no other variable that you can put into this input simulation. So I try to go to bed every single night at the same time, roughly around 9:30. I try not to eat dinner before that. I try to fast a little bit. The component of fasting is something that I found, you know, that works pretty well of having the empty stomach and that alertness that you get when you're hungry. And so I'll wake up the next day on Thursday and then I'll have my lift. In the morning, so I'll do a full body lift. It's called the game prep lift because it's the only lift that you're going to get that is going to go and help you, you know, play on Sunday. Thursday is when we introduce all our blitzes and our nickel looks. So it's, you know, a lot of second down and third down, and it's a heavy special teams day. So all the special teams will come in that day. The day ends at around 5:30, you know, come in at 6 o'clock, get your lift, go to meetings, get practice, you know, eat lunch or dinner. And then Thursday is usually our social day where we get together as friends and we would talk about every single issue that's happening that is bothering us. So you have to, it's almost like the AAR. This is when you get your AAR done. You discuss how you played last week. You discuss the game plan for next week. And then you talk to with your teammates who needs to step up that week, who needs to be able to maintain a performance, or for a specific type of plays, who needs to be able to play at their best. Friday is the most important day because it's situational football. So football is defined by those key moments of the game, you know, third and eight, fourth quarter, goal line. Like when you start the game on your goal line, when you're in the red zone. That's called situational football. When the game is not like the rest, basically. So when you're playing in the goal line or around the goal, you know, the field is a lot shorter. So the rules of the game change a little bit. And you cover all that on Friday. And Friday, you're done at 1 o'clock, 1:30. And that's kind of your day to, you know, for most players to get their haircuts, you know, to spend some time with their families. Saturday, we come in, we do a walkthrough of the game plan. Early in the morning, probably around, you know, 10 o'clock. I know it doesn't seem really early, but we're leaving right after that to go on the plane to the city that we're playing in. We do meetings again. We do one last review of everything. And then Sunday, you get up and play. Monday, you come, you watch the film, you get a lift. Your body at this point is feeling, I mean, it is pretty sad to see a bunch of NFL players on a Monday, you know, walk in towards the field to try to get a little bit of running in for the muscles because there's so much inflammation that you start this battle of reducing inflammation so that you can practice on Wednesday. Tuesday is the day off, but that's when most of the players go get their lift and get their treatment and start watching film to get ahead of Wednesday, and Wednesday you start it all over again. The game is, I mean, the week is incredibly, I mean, I can tell you exactly where I'm going to be doing at any point during the season for the entire season. I already know the schedule, and to me it requires no thinking whatsoever. Every single morning I have to wake up at 6 o'clock. I have to leave my house by 6:15. I'm not getting back until 5:30. And I know which days I have to push myself in the weight room, which days I have to make sure that I'm paying attention more and I'm more just to analyze the film. And at what time do I have to shut it off? You know, have no contact with the outside world because the game's about to start. And so it's a lot of fun finding out all the little variables, you know, what things work, you know, in terms of, you know, chiropractors. You know, I never understood what a chiropractor was, because chiropractors were not very, you know, popular in Europe when I was growing up. But apparently chiropractors, you know, they come and they advertise their services, and you have all these stories about performance, and you have to learn how to maneuver and do what's best for your body. Because a lot of times you find yourself, you know, believing in a training method or something that doesn't work at all. But, you know, because you don't have the ability to think on your feet and be unemotional about what is it that you're trying to accomplish, you end up following the wrong path. And so finding your routine, finding what works for you is incredibly valuable in the NFL. The preparation, the sleep is the biggest thing. And then the hydration is the second most important thing. And then everything else is just fire and adjust. You know, if you like to lift heavy during the week, you can lift heavy. If you like to lift heavy on Tuesdays, it's a matter of finding out what works best for you.
I think that also applies the same way. I mean, that same discipline, that same thing, understanding, you know, and the experience that, you know, guys are trying to figure out what their what's best for their bodies and how to recover and how to make gains. And that's what we have, you know, team leaders and squad leaders are also helping, you know, soldiers are going through this and providing some of that experience, because they know. I mean, they're like the, you know, grizzly veterans like yourself. They know what a squad live fire, what it takes, you know, to have, and they know what it's like to work kit for an extended period of time, so they can kind of prepare, you know, their team are going through that. But I think the aspect which you mentioned about sleep, nutrition, and hydration, and understanding what it does for your body is very, very important, as you mentioned.
Very important. And the last thing, the very unfortunate part is alcohol is the absolute worst thing, especially as you get older. I know sometimes a lot of players want to say they have their cheat day or their, you know, the day where they're allowed themselves to have a couple of drinks. What I found out as I get older is that cheat day is more and more costly as I get older. And so drinking becomes a thing that you have to start supplementing with a lot more coffee, which is bad for hydration. So, I feel as, you know, if you're able to have physical goals, if anything, that drive your decision-making, you know, you're going to be, you know, for the most part, you're going to be good to go. If you have no goals and you're just trying to deal with Sunday as it comes, then you're going to feel very unprepared. And that's sort of what determines a lot of times success in military units, is who comes the best prepared, who has the most information on the target, who has the most information on whatever it's, you know, what's happening and how we can move to from point A to point B. And the NFL is who has the most information going to Sunday that's going to help them excel.
Now, thanks for sharing that. I was wondering, you know, before, as we kind of tie up the ends of this conversation, is if you could share what you're still, I mean, it sounds like, you know, you're still passionate when you talk about your military experience. And I know just, you know, the conversation that you and I have had off to the side, and I've seen you, you know, come back and visit all your guys that you've worked with and guys that know you, you know, at Mountain Fest, and you're taking an opportunity to go back to West Point. What does it mean now to be a veteran, and how do you stay, you know, in contact with those that have served or that are now continuing to serve?
Yeah, so it's really interesting, you know, becoming a veteran in this role of being a veteran, because at first I had such close ties with everybody who's still on active duty that I consider myself as somebody who's still on active duty. And slowly I started losing the sir every single time I saw an officer, and slowly I started having my own thinking regarding some of the things that I did in the military and evaluate and, you know, sort of the decisions that were made when I was a platoon leader and I was serving in the war in Afghanistan. Pittsburgh has a lot of Vietnam veterans. I visit them every single week at the VA center, the VA hospital. And it's really interesting when you have a conversation from veteran to veteran, you know, how you're going to end up talking about the same issues, you know, the same stories that you were told when you were younger, and how that idea of war, you know, romanticized itself into reality. And I have a lot more admiration now and a lot of appreciation for our culture as a country, rather than specific, you know, individuals, because I know that the culture of servitude, of duty and responsibility that we have as Americans is going to produce the officers that are going to volunteer to serve. I feel, you know, especially if you compare it to other countries, the military is still seen as a very good organization for everybody in America to come in, you know, intermingle with people of different socioeconomic statuses, which doesn't really happen outside of, you know, places like the military. And it gives us the leaders that we trust. It gives us the those individuals that are gonna, you know, whether they stay in the military or they leave, that are going to make, you know, a lot of important decisions in our society. And so I feel that as if I do have sometimes, you know, a little bit more of a responsibility, because I should say things that maybe should be said, or maybe some people, you know, are expecting for veterans to lead the way in certain issues. But the good thing is that the military has also taught me a tremendous amount of humility, and always the impression that, you know, things are always what they seem, but they're really not. And so, if anybody's ever been to Afghanistan and ever served in Afghanistan, they can easily attest of how complex every single problem that you face as a leader unveils with, you know, not just what the military is, but also, you know, how the Afghans and their world is so complex that, you know, the more you know, the less you know. And you end up, you know, asking yourself a lot of questions and not really finding a lot of answers. And I feel like, you know, as a veteran, sometimes that's okay. I'm thankful for all the things that I learned. I feel as the Army did more to me than I did for the Army, and that always give me that sense of humility that there are men like you in uniform that are incredibly admirable for your commitment every single day, that there are soldiers that are serving under your command that are giving their all every single day. And if there's anything that I feel like I could ever do, then I should never hesitate to do it again, because, you know, this common cause that we all have together, this awesome country, this tremendous opportunity to enjoy freedoms that, you know, sometimes we take for granted, is pretty cool. And you know, sometimes every veteran probably will get bitter at some point about their careers, about the war that they had to serve and how it was compared to all the wars. I know that all the Vietnam vets always tell me that the World War II vets, you know, looked down on them because it was a hippie war and whatnot. But, you know, ultimately, I think those things matter less. Servitude and the culture that we have in our country is what's going to get us out of, you know, a lot of the issues that we face today and the day of tomorrow.
Well, Alejandro, my man, I really appreciate you sharing your story, giving some key insights. And we wish you the best in the season. You know, we always ask the team after we've had these conversations, what are your questions? But I'd like to leave the final word with you.
Life is a journey. Life is a journey. Life in the military, the NFL, is always trying to find greener pastures. And as long as you're always able to, you know, give yourself a why, a purpose, whether, you know, you're a platoon leader, whether you're a squad leader, whether you're a private that just joined the unit, if you're able to give yourself a purpose every single day regarding your military career, regarding who you are as a person, and be able to use life as a learning opportunity to try to get as much information from books, from conversations with people that you look up to, it's going to unfold everything, and it's going to give you all the answers to the test. We have a thing here in football that we call clean looks. It's somewhat like what you mentioned earlier regarding when you can think fast, so the battle drills. Clean looks is what drives you as a football player. It's being able to have the look that you saw at practice, the look that doesn't require any thinking, and it's a look where you just have to put your will into it and the play will work. And getting a play to work, getting any plan to work, whether you're an officer, enlisted, you're trying to go to college, you're trying to succeed in life, seeing the plans work is what gives you the gratification to come back again and try to get another Pro Bowl, try to get another CAB, and try to get another one of these meaningless things that drive us in life. But are pretty cool, you know, at the end of the day, to spend the time with other people that are sharing that same passion and the same desire to get the same things. The people that are around you are making your life, and so you have to value them as such.
Hey, Alejandro, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Leadership Experience. If you like what you heard, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date with the newest podcasts. The Leadership Experience will showcase professionals within five different subseries. Number one, Masters of Our Craft, The Essence of Warfighting. Number two, Students of Our Profession, as we understand organizational culture and concepts of leadership. Number three, Professional Athletes with Guns, as we talk hardships and maintaining a competitive advantage. Number four, Grit and Resiliency, the ability to overcome and perform under pressure. And number five, Safe and Secure Environment, as we talk soldier well-being and building trust within our organization and the profession as whole.